coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Hello, everybody. How you doing this Tuesday night? Chris Jordan here, coming at you live from Austin, Texas. We've got a heck of a show for you tonight, folks. In our second half, we have Gerard Artson. We will be talking about the world of exopolitics, a topic that I think, if you're not familiar with it, you should really get familiar with it. Like Stephen Bassett said from the Disclosure Project just a few weeks ago when he was on the show, he expects a major Big D disclosure announcement from the U.S. government by the end of summer. If any of you know, Stephen Bassett from the Disclosure Project is pretty much the first person to say, like, I am a disclosure lobbyist. That was back in the mid-90s whenever he started the Disclosure Project. And it's fantastic to see where it has come. It is fantastic to see the conversations once again that these topics have opened. But the topic that we need to be concerned about is, are we ready as a species for what that might mean? Are we ready to have political relations possibly with entities from outside of our own planet, whether they be interdimensional, interplanetary, what have you? And that even goes to speak to, are we philosophically ready as a people for things like what we're going to be talking about with our first guest tonight, our good friend King Gerhardt. He is the author of Monsters in Texas. He is the author of Menagerie of Mysterious Beasts. So many books that he has authored. We'll be getting to Ken in just a minute. And it's funny to know that even in the world of cryptozoology, there is this overwhelming want to not only confirm belief, but also for scientific want. And it's interesting to see those things not only play out, but kind of battle against each other sometimes, not only within the communities, but scientifically as well, to see NASA in their UFO UAP panel. Like I've said, say what you want about NASA, but the one plus side about their UFO UAP panel was when they actively called themselves out and called science out. And was like, it's funny because like the director of Arrow is going to tell us, there's a 3-5% anomaly of things that we can't explain. And I'm pretty sure that's the exact job of science, is to figure out things that we can't explain. So, like, there may have been a few fringe scientists. This may have been a science that was on the fringe, but it doesn't mean that it's a non-valid science. It doesn't mean that it's a science that shouldn't happen and a science that we shouldn't be doing, you know, that we shouldn't be actively looking into. And that's just it. We have to be ready as a species to accept the fact that, you know, hey, maybe we haven't discovered all of the species that are out there. I've got an article up right now that is fairly new. I mean, this is July 25th. So today, scientists discover new isopod species in the Florida Keys. We discover about 300-400 species a year. So whenever you hear the concept of, well, if it was out there, we'd have found it by now. Not really, man. Not so much. Welcome back to the show, King Gerhardt. How are you doing, my friend?
Hey, Chris. Always good to talk to you, my brother.
Absolutely. Let's kind of start cracking this nut, Ken, because once again, the idea of science to begin with, it's always funny to me whenever they shove away things like cryptozoology, like we were talking about with Ryan Edwards not too long ago. it is a science. It's just, it's not your average biology is all.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that there can be a marriage of traditional science, which, you know, I think is important to bring a level of credibility to all of these different endeavors. But, sure. You know, I personally pride myself on trying to, you know, approach my research as scientifically as possible. And that means, you know, data driven, of course. And, you know, I think the main thing is just trying to maintain as much objectivity as possible, because these are, you know, looking for an isopod. And I guess if you're a zoology nerd like me, then yes, discovering a new isopod, searching for it, doing all that research would be pretty cool. And I admire the people that do that kind of stuff. But then when you shift into the realm of cryptozoology, of course, you're dealing with these fantastical creatures like Sasquatch and lake monsters and chupacabras and things that people really, you know, there's like a whole nother level of fascination, because these are almost like mythological constructs, and the possibility that some of these things might be real, you know, that's a pretty mind-blowing proposition. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I agree with you, man. New animal discoveries, just recently, weeks ago, there was a new, species of snake discovered in Australia. It's like called a desert whip, highly venomous. I like everything in Australia.
What do you mean? It's like, we discovered two new koalas. They're both venomous.
Yeah, like- pretty much. It's a beautiful snake. It's like a bluish copper colored. And, you know, it's one of those things, you know, to give you some insight into some of how these, you know, when a new animal is quote unquote discovered in the scientific realm, it's called described. A new species is described. There's a paper written. It's, you know, usually in a prestigious journal, and then it's peer reviewed, and everyone in that field that specializes in whip snakes looks at the data and says, okay, yeah. But, you know, this particular species of snake, they kind of knew they were there. They were just mistaking them for another species that's found farther east. So it's kind of more of a point where they do like DNA testing or look at other characteristics and say, okay, it's unique enough. And then there's another one that was really cool. Last month, there was a new species of mountain gecko discovered in Vietnam. And, you know, that's not surprising, because Vietnam has yielded many new animal discoveries in recent decades. So, so yeah, it's all cool. And it gives hope, I guess, that, you know, maybe there are bigger things out there, that haven't been discovered, that is not impossible. So,
oh, absolutely. And that's just it. As we've had the conversation numerous times, as long as there is habitat, range, and ample food supply, you know, especially whenever you're talking about the age range of some animals, like, the article that I sent you about the huge, 8-foot alligator gar that was caught just south of Dallas. That thing is almost 100 years old.
Oh yeah. Those are cool.
It is. I used to love going out catfish and things like that. It's one of my favorite fish to catch. And well, because of the bait that you use, well, you catch a lot of alligator gars along the way.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And they were always a fun fish, just to fish, to catch, release, things like that. But yeah, I think about 3 feet was the biggest that I got. And those, they're fairly common. They get that big pretty frequently, but to see one that is 8 feet long, is just massive. And once again, really, really rings that prehistoric aspect to the critter, you know, interesting how much of the body is actively similar to the coelacanth, stuff like that.
Yeah, you're right. It's a very prehistoric looking fish. Atrartostia spatula is the Latin name. And I actually have a funny story. Well, it's kind of a cool story about it. You're talking about alligator gars. Yes, Texas, you know, one of the states where we regularly people catch 300-pound specimens in the riverways, you know, down in the Rio Grande Valley. I know they've found some monsters, the Trinity River.
Yep.
I grew up in Lake Jackson, Texas, which is on the Gulf about an hour south of Houston, and it was very swampy. And me and my friend at the time, I think I was in junior high school, had kind of a Stand By Me adventure where we decided to take a boat up Oyster Creek, which, you know, we'd never done, and we'd fished Oyster Creek, but, you know, what's up there if we keep, you know, kind of moving along the creek and see if we can find something cool. And right as we struck off, there was this is really weird, but there was like a carcass of a large dog floating in the creek. And it looked like a huge dog, like, I don't know, like maybe not a Mastiff, but something, pit bull or something. But anyways, something came up and took a bite out of it right as we were motoring past. And
wow.
And it was an alligator gar. And I, you know, of course I was a kid, but it looked like it was easily 6 or 7 feet long, and it kind of rolled in the water. And that was kind of like, you know, seeing something like that when you're a kid. I've had many kind of seminal moments in my childhood that kind of led me on to the path of cryptozoology. But that was kind of a cool one, because it almost felt like we were encountering some kind of monster there that was lurking in the creek. So,
yeah, yeah. And it's even to speak of monsters lurking in the water, one of the articles I popped up a second ago was another one that came out today talking about the giant eel theory. And Loch Ness, because that has been one of the larger going theories as of late for the Loch Ness monster. Is, you know, there are freshwater eels there. Perhaps it's like a nice 10, 12 foot eel, something like that, where you could see a few undulations at the same time. But apparently they have run DNA, all kinds of things, and that is not the case.
Well, yeah, this article was interesting. I think, yeah, you make a good point. First of all, we know that there are eels in Loch Ness, plentiful amounts of eels. That was proven by the DNA study in 2018 and 19 by Dr. Neil Gemmel.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was at that time, they kind of came out and made that broad pronouncement that, oh, the Loch Ness monster might be a giant eel because we have all this eel DNA, even though DNA doesn't tell you how big an animal it is. It just tells you there's an abundance of it. Here's the thing. I have some of the more conservative cryptozoologists like Richard Freeman from England and some of those guys that have spent time at Loch Ness. They embrace this giant eel theory because it seems a little bit more pragmatic than something like a plesiosaur or, you know, ancient prehistoric beast. But there's no evidence. I mean, the largest conger eels in Loch Ness, I think, get to be about 5 feet long. And those are rare. I mean, most of them are about 3 feet or even smaller. And as far as that species worldwide, the conger eel can get to be like 7 feet long in brackish waters in the ocean. And then you have species of marine eels like the moray eel that I guess can get to be 10 feet long. But there's not a lot of evidence there's no evidence that conger eels could reach the proportions that people describe when they see the Loch Ness monster. Their estimations are usually like 10, 15, 20, 40 feet long, you know, as far as what they're seeing above the surface. And it's a pretty big jump, you know, to speculate. And to me, it's just as fabulous to speculate, oh, okay, well, there's a conger eel, but it's, you know, 10 times bigger than any conger eel that's ever been found.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and Dr. Roy Mackle, who was a really bright cryptozoologist back in the day, talked about these eunuch eels, which are eels that lose their sex drive and they just kind of stay on the bottom of the lake and get, you know, who knows how big they get if they're staying close to the bottom. But I don't know. I think creating a new species is, you know, just as kind of tumultuous as proposing that there's some prehistoric animal that's still alive in there. So,
well, yeah. And, you know, you really do have to be careful with that because, like you're saying, it is no less sensationalistic because it's a little far fetched. Even alligator gar that are known to get to eight feet long, pretty rare to find them. Like you're saying, and there is no case of that type of eel being that large, period.
Yeah, it's just another form of speculation, which is a lot of what we do in this field. And there's nothing wrong with that because there is a scientific foundation in terms of the eel DNA and the fact that those animals are there. But it ignores the the evidence of all the eyewitness sightings, which number in the thousands now, and those are pretty consistent. So
yeah, and there was even the recent video that came out. I have it here from Marca, of the actual wild thing going on right here.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
In the waters. And, you know, hey, that could be one of many, many things. You know, once again, pretty large, but sure, that could be, I don't know if they have freshwater otters over there or anything like that. But that is a large thing for certain, flipping around in the water, and could be a log. All kinds of stuff. There have been many, many explanations for the things that have come out of Loch Ness, for the videos that have come out of Loch Ness. So,
yeah, and there have been a lot of hoaxes. You can't ignore that with regard to the Loch Ness case. Lots of famous hoax photos through the years. Okay, here's the thing, and I know I've kind of given myself a nickname lately, which is kind of Dr. Killjoy, which is what I do. When I come out to a lot of these forums, because, but this is just, and this is based on the researchers that have more boots on the ground there, like Steve Feltham and Roland Watson and some of those guys. But there's a particular gentleman that filmed this, and I can't even pronounce his name, Chris. He's Irish, and he's got a whole bunch of vowels in his first name and a whole bunch of consonants in his last name. But he's been doing this now for a few years, where he's got these – he watches these live streams of Loch Ness. There are cameras, stationary cameras set up around the loch that people can get onto various websites and kind of monitor the lake, see if they see something. And he's been spending a lot of time doing this in recent years and has come up with just – a number of videos that are what many researchers think are just like normal things on Loch Ness, like water birds swimming around. Yes, there are supposedly otters in Loch Ness. There are occasionally seals that come into Loch Ness. So, I mean, there's a lot of things. Debris actually can look kind of animated when it's moving against the current, which can happen in Loch Ness. Things can move against the current and stuff. So yeah, and the wave effects. So, but this particular guy seems like he's really making the most of his opportunities and doing what a lot of people are doing on social media now, and is just trying to get as many views and hits and, you know, clicks as possible. So it doesn't make sense that one individual would have had this many observations of the Loch Ness Monster when you have a lot of other researchers that are spending equal amounts of time or a lot of time trying to photograph things. So I'm a little skeptical about these particular videos. One of the shows that I'm on currently on the History Channel is called The Proof Is Out There, Friday nights at 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I think a couple weeks ago they had a video on there that was fairly recent from Loch Ness that I thought looked pretty good. I mean, it was actually, you could see more of the form of a large back, or what appeared to be a back, kind of swimming through the water, surging, creating a lot of displacement there. And, so yeah, there have been some compelling films from Loch Ness through the years, no doubt. The Dinsdale footage, the Gordon Holmes footage, sure. Some of the so yeah, I mean it's kind of a mixed bag, right? But I, you know, I definitely endorse the reality of something there in the lake that's unknown.
Absolutely. I am trying to get let me see what I can do here. Let me see if I can do this. Ooh, nope. That did. Oh, there it is. There's the champ image.
Okay.
Speaking of Loch Ness, I'm going to let me put something over this name. Typically, I would try and hide that. Let me see what I can do here. Bloop. Nope. Anyway, there is an image right there on screen, folks, of what people are claiming to be champ. In Lake Champlain, that is one of the many freshwater monsters here in America. This is pretty hot off the press. This popped up on social media all of a couple days ago, and it's been making the rounds. We were talking about it shortly before the show, and yeah, this is another example of things just kind of being put out there. And I'm not saying that isn't a very unique shape, things like that, but I don't know. I don't.
Yeah, it's intriguing. There's a lot, you know, there is sonar evidence. That's over actually the overlooked line of evidence in a lot of these lake monster cases. We do have several good sonar contacts from Loch Ness dating back to 1954.
Yep.
And from Lake Champlain, Katie Elizabeth, the researcher up there, has had some compelling contacts. I certainly don't pretend to be a sonar expert, Chris. No. It's a very complicated technology. The basics, which most people probably understand, are that you're bouncing sound waves through the water and they're reflecting off things and coming back, and then you're kind of analyzing those echoes. But from what I understand, and there are different levels of sonar in terms of, you know, quality and features and things, but a sonar contact is not always an exact representation of the shape of something, particularly if that object is moving.
Yeah.
Because it's taking a certain amount of time to kind of, you know, for those echoes to reflect and for everything to be analyzed. And so what the main things you can tell is roughly how big something is, or if it's large, if it's just a fish or a school of fish or something, you know, that like this is kind of like, I don't know if that is a school of fish. I mean, certainly it looks like it has appendages of some kind.
Cool. You can see my mouse on screen. If you look, it also kind of looks like it has things supporting it.
Yeah. That's
right there.
Right.
Like it's more down. That's one of the interesting things. Isn't it Loch Ness where there is an actual model sunk in the lake?
Oh, yeah. The something Sherlock Holmes movie that was made in the late 60s. Billy Wilder was the director. And, yeah, they had built a Loch Ness model that they were going to tow behind the boat. And he apparently had them, try to put this thing lower in the water. He thought it was sticking up too high. And they took some of the ballast out and it finally just like snapped off. And there was a submarine towing it. I think it was a Pisces submarine. It just snapped off and sunk to the bottom. But you're right. A few years ago, they found it on sonar.
Yeah.
You know, unmistakably the shape of a monster type thing kind of just sitting on the bottom there. So,
but at the same token, the sonar evidence that's out there aside from that, once again, fantastic. And yes, the technology used in that image that we were showing just a second ago, definitely side scan sonar. Not as though, a lot of people are used to the sonars, like fish finders, things like that, where you're looking at it from a top down view.
This
is side scan sonar where it kind of does the same thing, but goes out and back.
Absolutely.
You can get some very detailed images with it for certain.
It's worth looking at the depth too, which I think this was like 80 something feet. Now, obviously there are sightings of these things at the surface, so they would come to the surface eventually, but I think most of the credible or compelling sonar contacts through the years have all pretty much averaged greater depths, at least in Loch Ness. Like 200 to 500 feet down is where some of the really impressive ones that haven't been explained. So, that's interesting that maybe these things, you know, they stay in the depths, except for, you know, occasionally they might come to the surface. Who knows? All speculation, like I said.
So. Absolutely. Absolutely. And where was it? There was. There we go. Out of I-95 was the report of a Bigfoot. A recording of Bigfoot being captured, and the audio is not banging. but I'm going to go ahead and play some of it because this kind of exemplifies, I think, Ken, some of the things that researchers are up against whenever you're talking about evidence gathering, that kind of stuff. And some of the quality issues that can come around, with what you get to deal with. Here's the actual audio.
Thank you.
Pretty interesting. I've actually got the audio here in better format. And there's the original clip. You can definitely hear like a big vocalization right here. So, yeah, that's... You can hear a large hoot sound. That was me repeating it there at the end, from my edit, and it's hard sometimes, the things that are out there in communities, the not only the images, but the audio, the video, things like that, trying to be able to clean them up, use them. You can definitely hear what sounds like huge, large bullfrogs if you're familiar with those. But then there is a couple of sounds in there that are pretty loud vocalizations in the background.
Yeah, I mean, interesting, but you know, I've heard certainly better audio evidence through the years. I mean, I don't know why we're making a particularly big deal out of this one, but no.
I think it's more like you said, better audio evidence. Once again, to show what you guys are up against. Whenever communities come to you with, "Hey, man, I have something for you."
There was a discussion that was had at the Texas Bigfoot Conference, I think last year, and I probably came off as a little bit obnoxious when someone in the audience asked, you know, why don't you guys spend a lot more effort on, you know, audio recordings, having them analyzed? And there are researchers doing that. There's a guy named David Ellison.
Sure.
The Olympic Project and guys that are specializing in that. So that is a thing. But, you know, my answer is that, you know, audio recordings, unfortunately, are kind of in the same category as alleged videos and photos and things, that they're, you know, just highly open to interpretation and just never potentially could never be conclusive evidence that you could take into an academic situation and show a scientist and say, but look how good that photo is. And listen to this. I mean, they're not going to, you know, it's a physical evidence is really the crown jewel of this type of research, DNA or bones or teeth. I think it adds to the evidence. And I think people should continue to record audio and try to get photographic evidence. But I don't know if it's, pragmatic to spend a ton of resources in that area. I mean, look, Bigfoot researchers are typically broke for the most part, and don't have a lot of resources and are spending as much time as they can out there. And it's just a matter of, just like any industry you're in, Chris, it's about, you know, resourcing, putting your resources into your best, whatever it is, your best chance of accomplishing a goal or doing something. So I think, I think the emphasis should really still be on DNA collection and searching for remains, because I mean, if these animals exist, they're huge, there has to be a breeding population, they're going to leave bones and teeth and things. They got to, you know,
yeah,
I don't know. I'll get off my soapbox.
A necessary soapbox, Ken. I am in full and utter agreement with you. I as well. Whenever I step into a lot of social communities, am called a debunker, and I'm like, I'm not a debunker. I'm sorry if, you know, I've worked in audio and video for the better part of my life. I've spent the last 30 something years almost behind a lens in some way, shape or form, whether it's, you know, shooting footage or editing it or broadcasting it, what have you. So, yeah, I can spot a lot of anomalies. I can spot a lot of things pretty quick. And given a good 20, 30 minutes to use a piece of software or something, can toss out a lot of things. But once again, there is a 5% there, pretty much across the board, paranormally, where there are anomalous things. There are results. Once again, the allele results that are coming out with oils, things like that, oil prints. Fascinating. Very, very interesting to see. And once again, like you're saying, to see the actual science being applied, to see things like forensic sciences, like what they use in murder investigations, fingerprint alleles, things like that. Remarkable. Remarkable to see that technology being leveraged in these fields.
Yeah. Well, the new, you know, again, the big things in the, or the new things in the Bigfoot field, I think the technologies that seem to be really catching on are obviously, you know, FLIR and thermal imaging has been around for probably a while now, but it's getting better and it's getting more affordable. There was a time when no Bigfoot researcher could afford a real good thermal imaging with recording capabilities and all that stuff. And now I've seen some recently for just a few hundred bucks that are pretty impressive. So that's, you know, if something has a heat signature, it can't hide from that in theory. So, I mean, that's a pretty cool toy. Drones obviously have been very big in recent years, and people attaching cameras and different other things to drones, and LIDAR. And LIDAR, of course, is something that we've seen, you know, being used more frequently. So all of these things are giving us tools, at least, I think. And that's promising that we're getting better technology that, you know, might help us, you know, achieve this seemingly impossible task.
Well, and I don't know that it's necessarily impossible, Ken. I think that we're getting once again better and better and closer and closer. It seemed impossible all of 3-4 years ago that we would be having any kind of conversation about UFO UAP on the floor of Congress.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
Know. And as I've said numerous times in the last few episodes, I'm pretty sure that the conversation is happening more than political conversations around people's dinner tables. You know, it's interesting to see over the last few years, the societal change, the societal acceptance of the topic, just in general conversation in public.
Yeah. Well, I don't, admittedly, I've never looked at any surveys, at least not recently that I can remember, but in terms of Bigfoot, there have been a number of surveys that have been done amongst the public just to find out how, you know, what percentage of people actually think or believe it could be real. And it's usually that percentage wavers between 18 to 29%. But I'm sure for UFOs, it's much higher than that. I know that pretty much everyone that I've ever met has seen at least one thing that they would characterize as a UFO at one time or another. So doesn't mean it's close encounters, but something they couldn't explain. And I've seen one myself. So, I mean, I find it fascinating, but it's not surprising to me that that would be embraced by things like, you know, in public forums, like in Congress and stuff, before we get to cryptids and, you know, I don't know. What about ghosts and all that, too? I mean, so many people have had experiences with that kind of stuff. So,
and there is, interestingly enough, the conspiratorial vein in the cryptid community, Ken, is no different than the conspiratorial vein in the UFO UAP community. It is absolutely fascinating to see that and to watch that. Not only in social media, everything. I mean, even to the point of the federal government knows about Bigfoot. Federal government is keeping people away from it. They have agreements with the Bigfoot population. It gets thick. It gets thick. And not saying that, hey, maybe they do know about Bigfoot. Who knows?
Well, you know, it permeates all of the fields. But it's kind of a straw man argument, right? Because it's like, you know, the true believers will always have a reason that we don't have the evidence. You know, why haven't we been able to prove it? Oh, the government. You know, it's like,
well, and it's like the conversation that we have regularly here. The true believer, you will never change the true believer, can. I have experiences in my life that you will not tell me that they did not happen. Like, I'm sorry. There was a shadow person at the end of my bed, and it grabbed me, man. Like,
I'm not laughing at that. I'm sure that was a very scary situation.
No, because hey, like me and my spiritual director had it out over it. And I was like, we got a serious crisis of conscience here, Padre. Because, wow, I'm telling you, this happened to me. And once again, you know, you're never going. People believe because they believe, Ken.
Oh yeah,
And you will never sway that to think that you could sway that with any kind of science fact, anything like that. Like you can't.
And that's why, you know, typically I'm respectful, Chris. Absolutely, I think most people know that any people that have met me or worked with me in the field know that I'm open-minded and I'm, you know, I'm not a jerk to people, you know, but I do like you. We were talking about this earlier. We ask questions, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. I encourage anyone when we're talking about these things to not just accept everything you hear, but question a lot of it. And you're right. There are a lot of people, and many of them are my supporters, and I appreciate that, that are, you know, that I don't engage when they present alleged evidence and things on, you know, whatever, because it's, you know, like you said, you're not going to win that argument. I mean, if someone is convinced that they have a family of Bigfoots in their backyard and they're having picnics with them and things like that, I can't disprove it. They can't prove it, but.
And you know, very, very much the same token, there's a person on a UFO group that I belong to that posts videos about 2-3 times a week that it's like, I can't even explain to you the flight path of where you live anymore, my friend. Explain to you the convergence of lights at a distance when you're in a flight path. Yeah, it's one of those, like, if you had that in your backyard four or five nights a week, I'd venture to say you'd be selling tickets.
Right.
You know, it would be a local attraction. It would no longer be an anomaly. It's now a known quantitative that it happens every Wednesday, you know? We have to be A, respectful of that, and B, be willing to accept that there is a part of the community that is separate, you know?
You know, we can all live in harmony.
Absolutely.
I do conferences with people that, you know, habituators and people that have kind of extreme views based compared to mine, but we, you know, we agree to disagree. And, you know, the main thing is that we're all there kind of, you know, trying to discover our own truths. Right. So,
yeah. Well, and you know, once again, you never know, man. It is a wild, wild world out there. We talk about it regularly on the show. The fact that science fiction is now science fact. It's remarkable, the things, the technologies that are out there, Ken.
No, that's true.
I would not put it past us being able to, in the next few years, have better technology to be able to find something like a large hominid species roaming the woods of North America and other continents.
Here's another aspect, Chris, that's kind of interesting. I'm, as you know, I'm a volunteer at the San Antonio Zoo, docent, a volunteer educator. Just recently, I had the great pleasure of going behind the scenes in our avionics department, the bird specialists, and we're one of the top bird zoos in the country. And I actually spoke to the Joseph, who's the head, been there for like 40 years. And we talked about the ivory-billed woodpecker, if you're familiar with Campaphylus principalis, the god bird. Supposedly it went extinct in the 30s or 40s. But there have been pretty aggressive searches in recent decades, including Cornell University, their ornithology lab, and other universities. There have been alleged sightings and videos and things. I'm currently corresponding with a researcher in Louisiana who thinks he's seen them. But Joseph brought up a great point, which was, because he's a bird breeding Phenom. That's what we do at the San Antonio Zoo, is we breed highly endangered birds, Micronesian kingfishers. We help save the whooping crane from extinction. I mean, and what he talked about is, you know, pretty obvious, but I never really considered genetic bottlenecking, which, you know, once you get down to a certain number of individuals in any species and there isn't enough genetic diversity among those individuals, that's really creating a lot of problems for their offspring, because their offspring are more likely to have, you know, genetic conditions, immunity problems.
Absolutely.
Things like that. So, yeah. I mean, if any of these animals are that incredibly rare, which, you know, I've always kind of thought about that, you know, it's like, well, maybe these things, maybe we can't find them because there's only just a small number of them left, whatever that small number is, that's another discussion. But, you know, with regard to Sasquatches, I think there are a few thousand across North America, which I still think makes them incredibly rare.
Oh, absolutely.
But I guess, you know, that's the minimum number that it would take to avoid that type of genetic bottleneck to where they're just dying off and going extinct. So,
yeah. And that there are many prime examples of that genetic bottleneck. I mean, whenever you start a prime, a really good example is dog species, dog breeds rather, because there's just the species of dog. Mm-hmm. Every single dog that's out there and every breed of dog that's out there has been made by man and culled from wolf, all the way down to a rat terrier, for exactly what they're made for. Now, the issue is some of those breeds, like English bulldogs, because of their characteristics, things like that, were bred that way and bred into a point of actively having health issues because of the way that we wanted them to look. And now it's the fact that generations down the line, same thing with Dalmatians. They were bred because of their incredible hearing and eyesight, and specifically bred for life-saving purposes, things like that. But the lack of crossbreeding started making a great number of them deaf, partially blind, things like that. And that's a big thing whenever you go out to buy a Dalmatian. If that's what you're looking for, you need to make sure that you aren't getting one that is of that genetic inbred stock. Because eventually, without, like you're saying, without the genetic crossbreeding going on, between things, things get weakened.
Yeah. And, you know, another example of that at the zoo is that, you know, we'll swap, you know, we have affiliations with the AZA and other organizations where we actively swap animals around the country so that, you know, if one pair of jaguars has cubs, we don't want them to have that same couple to have too many cubs. So we'll switch our male with another male or whatever to create that genetic diversity, because that is important to have a healthy lineage. Speaking of dogs, is that a good segue? I don't know.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Well,
Not dogs so much. Oh yeah, there you go. I saw a couple of those guys. We're trying to breed a pair of those right now. It's pretty cool. I actually got to handle a Guam rail, which is one of the rarest birds in the world. It's extinct on the island of Guam. So that was pretty cool, just for a minute.
Incredible.
Speaking of dog man, if anyone's interested. We're organizing a conference, of course, Labor Day weekend. It's going to be in White Settlement, Texas, just on the it's actually a suburb of Fort Worth, or probably within Fort Worth proper. And it's actually very close to Lake Worth, Greer Island, home of the Lake Worth monster, the Lake Worth Goatman. So we're about 10 miles south of there. If anybody comes to the conference, they might want to go explore Greer Island and look for the Goatman. But there you go. There's the speakers. 2 days.
An incredible speaker list as well.
It's really impressive. I mean, all those researchers are outstanding, and the presentations are going to be world class. And there will be vendors, books, and t-shirts, and all kinds of swag. And, you know, it goes back to kind of what we were talking about earlier about different perspectives, because I've interviewed a number of dogman witnesses. You know, it's certainly more far out there than something like Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster, in my opinion, because this is something that genetically, biologically, should not exist. people have seemingly have had valid experiences, and we're all going to get together and talk about it. And there's a lot of different opinions about what this phenomenon represents. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, it's going to be super interesting. I can't wait to go. I'll be doing the AV there. It's going to be fantastic. I'm excited about it because it is a very interesting topic whenever you get into the world of Dogman and paranormal cryptozoology. Mm-hmm. That cross link between the two. And I was even in one of the groups not too long ago, I was trying to explain to somebody that no, the idea of lycanthropy and werewolf goes back to ancient Greece. Like that is far beyond Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. King Lycan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's
you're right. And even farther back maybe than that, if you look at Anubis, the dog headed god in Egyptian mythology, and maybe some other Asian mythologies and legends. So yeah, it is one of those kind of enduring things. But you know, the fascinating thing, of course, is that we didn't hear a whole lot about Dogman until the late 80s and early 90s. And then there was this kind of explosion. Mm. So, like you said, there were all the mythologies and legends. But now there are all these eyewitnesses that are coming out of the woodworks. Pretty terrifying encounters. Pretty chilling stuff when you speak to some of these people and they describe their experiences.
Absolutely. And it's remarkable to once again see how ready people are to talk about it. How ready they are. There used to be, I think, a lot more, I wouldn't necessarily say shame, but more reticence on people's parts to come forward with their accounts of such things. And popular culture has really brought forth the concept that it's okay to have these kind of experiences.
Yes, absolutely. And there are all kinds of platforms now with these different podcasts like Paranormal Roundtable.
Oh, absolutely.
Sponsoring the event. A lot of people that have come on and told their story. So, that's always a good thing, Christopher. I mean, for years, even before podcasts were a thing, I had a lot of eyewitnesses reach out to me through the years, and they were – you know, I felt like it was very therapeutic of them to kind of get it off their chest, so to speak, and speak to someone, an investigator that is, you know, very open-minded and will listen to them and not ridicule them. And oftentimes, you know, provide some, maybe not closure, but like, you know, hey, you're not the only person who claims to have seen that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have another report from this area, and sometimes those little, you know, those help.
That's an interesting point because whenever we have like Reverend Michael J.S. Carter from Ancient Aliens on, the idea of when he had his experience, it wasn't like you could hop online and find your local UFO UAP experiencer support group. You know, right. You couldn't even hop on a bulletin board system and find that, you know. So trying to find somebody who was A, of like mind, be open enough to share that experience with you that, hey, these things came in my room, you know, and not look at you like you have three eyes.
Right.
You know, to know that, there are now discussion groups. There are now discussion boards. Things like that are regularly happening. Get-togethers, all that kind of stuff. The community of people sharing their stories is absolutely beautiful and fantastic. And that's what I love to see.
Yeah, it really is. It's unfortunate, but I'll see one of my colleagues in the cryptozoology or Bigfoot field kind of complain about the culture and say that there, you know, there's a lot of drama or conflict or whatever. And yeah, there's, you know, you're going to get that in any field.
Good Lord, go join a church.
in any occupation or career or industry, you're right. You're always going to have politics and big personalities.
Yeah.
But I would say that I love the Bigfoot cryptid community. I travel around the country and do conferences all over the place. And by and large, all the people are really nice, respectful, interesting, intelligent. And, you know, there's always a few bad apples here and there. But yeah. I don't know. I think you make a great point there. Everyone's and I'm sure it's the same with the UFO scene and the ghost scene. I've done a couple of UFO conferences like AlienCon earlier this year. Mm. But I've got a quick funny story about UFO Please. Researchers. I did the Edinburgh UFO Festival and conference down there in Edinburgh, Texas last year. I was a speaker. And, you know, it was very well organized. They've been doing it there for years. And they gave us all a schedule, all the speakers a schedule. And there was a van that was going to come by and pick us up for dinners and different things that we needed to be at. And I noticed that the UFO researchers were always late. So I would get down there. I was always on time. The van pulled up. Okay, here we are, 7 o'clock. Where's everyone else? And so I'd run around in the lobby and I'd find a UFO researcher sitting there, and there's one up in his room. And I kind of gave him a lot of grief a lot about that. I said, hey, you UFO researchers, I figured you guys would be all like military by the clock, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, here we go. OCD, but apparently
don't get me started with with conference OCD, Ken. You know my OCD.
Yes, sir.
Wait a minute. Where's your presentation? But no. I've even seen amongst the community, I would say, because I support a lot of different communities, I sponsor a lot of different conferences, and I would say amongst it, the Bigfoot cryptid community is definitely the most, brotherly. When dinner's done, it's like, hey, who's going camping tonight?
Right. Well, you got that. The Bigfoot community is kind of that outdoorsy, you know, yeah, sitting around the campfire, drinking beer, telling stories. I guess the UFO people are.
They tend to be a little more compartmentalized.
Yeah.
Whenever it comes to social things, stuff like that afterward. And it's interesting to see just the dynamics of the groups amongst things in the different conferences I've been at over the last couple of years.
You know what else is funny, Chris? I just sorry to talk over you though, that watching some older UFO conferences and sometimes Bigfoot conferences, but back in the 80s, 90s or whatever, MUFON conventions, and everyone's wearing like a suit and tie and a jacket. It was like more of a corporate.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you notice that? It's like, it was like really like proper. And now like everyone just shows up with like your favorite.
They got their cargo shorts. Yeah. So I've got my Boggy Creek shirt on under this shirt. So
yeah, it's a little more casual. But no, I don't mean to make fun. The UFO researchers that I've worked with are incredibly intelligent, very bright people, and I think it's a fascinating topic.
It is. It's super fun. And I want to thank you for coming on, doing the cryptid news thing. I think it's fantastic to do every couple few months, just kind of go over some of the things in the field, some of the stuff going on in the communities. And of course, promoting the upcoming Dogman conference. I am greatly looking forward to that. It's going to be fantastic, folks. It is up in White Settlement, just outside of Fort Worth, second annual Dogman Cryptid Conference put on by Paranormal Roundtable, our good friends.
Tickets are on Eventbrite.
That's right.
I don't know if we have the link there, but if people just go to Eventbrite and type in any of those catchwords there, they can find tickets there.
Yeah, and we have links all over our website, folks. You can find it down here in our conferences area. It's in our on-location calendar. You just click the date, and it'll take you right to the Eventbrite. So makes it nice and easy. Feel free to go on Facebook and find them as well. Ken, where can everybody go to keep up with your work? I mean, of course, we have your videos and your YouTube embedded in our videos page.
Appreciate that.
Well, absolutely, man. We like to make it nice and easy for our listeners to find all of the stuff from our guests. So, but where can they go to keep up with all of your work? Where can they go to especially keep up with all of the episodes you're on? Because like you said, you were on quite a few shows.
Well, I appreciate that, Chris. It's always great to be here with you. It's an honor. Let's see. Well, I have a website, kengerhard.com. Badly in need of a revamp, but I also am all over social media, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, or whatever it's called now. And people can follow. Oh, and yes, I have I'm currently appearing on The Proof Is Out There, which debuts every Friday night at 9 o'clock after a new episode of Ancient Aliens.
Fantastic. And once again, you can also find Ken at the upcoming Dogman Cryptid Conference in White Settlement. So, Ken, thanks so much for the time, bud. I appreciate you taking the time to come on. I know your schedule is insane, as always. So,
thank you, Chris.
Good on you for being so busy. And thank you for everything that you do for not only the community, but for the field of cryptozoology and Bigfoot research.
Well, I appreciate that. Very kind of you to say. And thank you to everyone who took some time tonight to listen in.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. Please take care, Ken. I'll make sure to send you links, all that kind of good stuff for sharing everything else. You have a great night, my friend.
Okay. You too, brother.
All right. See you soon. Take care.
Bye.
While you are online checking out all of the amazing work of Ken Gerhard, folks, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can find all of our content. That's where you can find all of our episodes. CuriousRealm.com. CuriousRealm.com/store is where you can find Ken Gerhard's books. That's where you can find books from all of our guests. That's where you can find our swag, folks. Stay tuned through this commercial break. When we come back, we will be having our pre-recorded conversation, as always. Our guest in our second part this evening is Gerard Artson. We will be talking about the topic of exopolitics, the idea of, are we ready as a humanity to converse with other species from outside of Earth or from an alternate Earth? We'll be getting into that and so much more with Gerard right after this, folks. Hello, everybody, and welcome back from that commercial break. Thank you so much to our sponsors, WebWorks Wireless. WebWorks Wireless is our sponsor that provides all of our live streaming to our website every week, all of our live streaming from on location whenever we are out doing remotes, like we were this last week when we were in Salem, Massachusetts. We were live pushing the episode out to our website and everything else pre-recorded fashion. So WebWorks Wireless provides all of those services for us. Stop on by, check them out, folks. They're your home for no data limits, no throttling, and no credit check wireless internet. I have not had an issue since I started using them. They are fantastic. Stop on by and check them out, webworkswireless.com. While you are online checking them out, make sure to stop on by the website of our guest today, Gerard Artson, bgapublications.nl. For those of you not familiar, that .nl, folks, is for the Netherlands. He is a researcher from the Netherlands. He is also the author of UFOs, The Power of Oneness, The Invisible Ocean, as well as his newest book, The Adamski Book of UFO UAP Disclosure. We will be talking about the world of disclosure with him, the topic of Big D disclosure, like we did a few weeks ago with Stephen Bassett, what those implications are for humanity. And exactly what is exopolitics? Is humanity ready for the concept of exopolitics? And for those of you unfamiliar, this goes beyond like Starfleet Federation, folks. This goes beyond the concept of a UN. It's how do we as a humanity connect with another species? How do we connect with an intelligence from beyond, should that happen? So welcome to the show, Gerard Artson. How are you today?
Thank you, Christopher. I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
Doing fantastic. I got a chance to spend some time with your new UFO UAP disclosure book. Before we get deep into the conversation, familiarize our audience a little bit with
your work, how you came to the field of UFO UAP disclosure studies and research.
Well, I've been a student of what is known as the Age's Wisdom for I think over for 45 years now. I'd read George Adamski's two main books, Flying Saucers Have Landed and Inside the Spaceships, way back when, and did not much with them, but I did see the correlation with the teachings that I was studying. In 2008, 2009, I started writing articles about stuff that I found out about Adamski that was ignored or dismissed by most other people writing about Adamski, because you may well know that he's been dismissed and ridiculed and derided for not only last 10, 20 years of his life, but ever since, even more so ever since his passing. I felt it was important to inform people of the actual facts and the context of his claims, his accounts, and his philosophy, his teaching. And at one point, I had written a number of articles, and there was more information coming my way. So then I decided, well, let me try and write a book. And that was my first book in 2010, George Adamski, A Herald for the Space Brothers, which is out of print now because I'm preparing a new revised and enlarged edition. And that's actually where it started, because the information that came out through Adamski was also, I found, confirmed in the accounts of the other early 1950s contactees. Once you start looking into things, you find more and more. And I recovered some interesting original materials, which I then tried to include in my books. Some of Adamski's texts that have not been available for 65 or more years are now available in some of my books again. My latest book has a compilation of essays titled We Are Not Alone in the Universe, which was published in India, and one of the essays was written by George Adamski. So for me, Adamski's information and the corroborations from other contactees, and especially from the teachings that I've been studying all my life, and increasingly confirmations, corroborations from the scientific, the avant-garde of science, post-materialist science, as it's becoming to be known. I thought it's so compelling that's how I came to especially write to my last couple of books, Pioneers of Oneness, and now the Adamski Book of UFO UAP Disclosure, where I present 6-7 exhibits correlating Adamski's claims, accounts, with very recent confirmations from science, from the military, and science philosophers. So it's fascinating.
Well, and it is very, very fascinating, because especially looking at the concept of exopolitics, looking at the concept of disclosure from the point of view of an experiencer, like Adamski, even our guest that we have on, Kathleen Martin, who is the head of the experiencer resource team for MUFON. She is the niece of Betty and Barney Hill. To see the fact that, and there are a lot of people who call into question the experiences of Betty and Barney Hill. And the one thing that I always remind them is never forget, our star map of that system did not exist at that time. The star map that Betty Hill reported from her experience. We did not confirm until years later as being astronomically correct.
And there are similar pieces of information that have come from George Adamski that were not known at his time, but were later confirmed. For instance, the Van Allen belts. Adamski was shown or noticed on one of his trips in space this radiation belt that the ship was navigating, and he indicated the where it was located in our solar system, and this was not known at the time, and only later was it found by science and named the Van Allen belt.
Well, and that's just it. To know that experiencers came back with this kind of information that was later fully accredited by science, fully shown to be correct. There are more than one occasion, even whenever you look at things like the Dogon tribe in Africa and their belief that they came from a binary star system. They have like a working kind of model that they use of that representation. And yeah, we found out years later that star system is actually a binary star system. Right. They've been talking about it for thousands of years as the source of their people. One of my favorite things was seeing the mainstream media kind of pick apart things from Graham Hancock and his recent series that came out, and calling him a pseudoscientist. And hilariously, never once has Graham Hancock ever claimed to be a scientist. He is an investigative journalist. All he does is follow trails of information and data. That's it.
You know, we see that throughout definitely recent history, people with revolutionary insights, they are ridiculed, they are derided and dismissed as, like you say, pseudoscientists or peddling a new religion. This is true for George Adamski, as it was true for Madame Blavatsky, who in the late 19th century presented for the first time in to modern humanity, what I referred to as the Ages Wisdom teachings, which was the first, her books were the first in modern times to propose the fundamental nature of consciousness. You know, consciousness, she said, is fundamental to our objective reality, and it is universal. It's not confined to the space inside our skull. It's an underlying principle in the universe. Oh. And she was the first. She was the first to do that. Adamski he was trained, in fact, as a youth in Tibet by some of the same teachers that Madame Blavatsky studied with, and also by his contacts from space, and he had a very deep insight into that aspect of reality, and that ties in with what you started the show with, the philosophical side. We call it philosophical, but in fact, and some would call it metaphysical, but that is the more fundamental side to our physics. If you ask a physicist what is matter, and you ask him to take you with electronic microscopes into the atoms that make up our solid physical objects, they will show you that there's nothing there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was going to say, for the first thing they'll say is, well, let's define empty space.
Exactly.
Let's define empty space, because even this last year, the fact that the Nobel Prize went to quantum entanglement.
fully confirms what so many, I'm getting ready to go to the Remote Viewing Association conference again this year. And I cannot wait to go, because that is the concept of non-local consciousness, Gerard. And the idea that you and I are connected right now, you're in the Netherlands, I'm in Austin, Texas. By all means of physics, we're sharing electron shell. And that is a point that I bring up on my show all the time, because I learned that in high school, like chemistry in 1993. That is no new concept in physics, but it's interesting to see physicists now turning toward what we would be looking at as metaphysics all of 20, 30 years ago.
Exactly. And the interesting thing is, you know, we are now used to being interconnected constantly from moment to moment through our social media. But it's merely a physical plane reflection of a reality, a fundamental reality. There's nothing separate in the whole universe. And the interesting thing, you mentioned non-locality. Well, George Adamski, in fact, explained the concept of non-locality in layman's terms in correspondence in the 1950. So that's almost 75 years ago, before it was really, you know, catching on in scientific circles.
Yeah. Well, let's get into a little bit of the experience of George Adamski and how that led to his work and what that relates to with Big D disclosure, as we talked about with Stephen Bassett, the idea that are we getting ready right now to hear, for at least from the United States government? There have been numerous governments. France, I want to say the Netherlands was among. No, the Netherlands has not released any documentation regarding UFOs, UAPs.
I'm not aware of anyone in government here that takes UFOs or UAPs seriously here.
Okay,
and, it's so interesting to see the media now, hesitatingly, around the world, not just in Holland, hesitatingly accepting the notion that, maybe if the Pentagon says there is something they can't explain, there may be something to that notion that we've been ridiculing for all this time.
Yeah. And I mean, France released documentation years ago. I know Italy was shortly to follow. There have been quite a few there in the EU that have said for years that we are at least looking into this as something that we, our scientists and our military, don't know what's going on. And we've finally hopped on board here in America. It's interesting to see some of the rhetoric going on right now politically with, we don't know if humanity can handle it. That is some of the latest headline to come out of Washington from Schumer, is that we don't know if they can handle some of the things that we've seen in closed panel.
That was confirmed actually in December 2020 when Professor Ashed, the professor of astronautics and the former head of Israeli space program, said, we know that contact has been made, but the extraterrestrials have asked not to make this public because humanity isn't ready yet.
Yeah, precisely. And it even went as far as, and Trump knows about it, was the headline out of NBC News. Former Israeli space security chief says extraterrestrials exist and Trump knows about it. Now, granted, there is more than one person. We have had the whistleblower Grush come out recently talking about crash retrieval programs. There has been more than one concept out there of either reverse engineered technology being in our skies or technology of extraterrestrial origin. I choose to probably see quite a bit of what we are seeing as more interdimensional, possibly even us from another dimension, something along those lines. But at the same time, the concept of exopolitics, I think people get caught up with the idea of extraterrestrial being literally ET, Gerard. We need to remember that much like paranormal just means something outside of the norm. We don't have to go
something
to the
outside our norm.
Yeah, we don't have to go to the extreme of what it is. It's just not normal. It's outside of what we consider norm.
Yep.
You know,
something that has thus far escaped our perception or our norm.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And we have to be ready for that perception of reality to shift. And we have to be ready for that pretty quickly, I think. We have technologically come a long way, but even to see the struggles right now going on societally with accepting AI, and the utter fear behind it. Like, I use AI regularly, man. That stuff's fun. I have no fears that it's going to start launching nuclear missiles next week. You know, I think we are like way, 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 way far away from that, and that we will have a firm grip control of that by the time that comes around, if that comes around at all, Gerard. However, the chances of us running across another civilization, even here on our planet, I think is pretty big.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and that's you know, you mentioned George Adamski's experiences.
Yes,
and that's exactly, he was the first to come out. He was not the first. He didn't claim that he was the first to have been contacted. His contact first. Physical plane, personal, person-in-person contact happened in November 1950, what was it, 53? 52. November 1950. You know, this was a physical plane. He had had earlier experiences, which he described in his book, Pioneers of Space. That was dismissed as, you know, science fiction. I am sure it was, you know, he wrote it in a fictionalized way because he knew at the time people were not ready yet to accept the notion of visitors from space.
Yeah.
And he had the ability, which, you know, I've shown based on other accounts, he had the ability to consciously leave his body and travel in consciousness, or, you know, remote viewing. You might call it remote viewing.
Yep.
Well, his privilege was that he met people from space who made a point of, you know, appearing to him in full physical manner, in physical bodies. You mentioned interdimensional beings. I think it would help to expand our notion of what physical is. We here on Earth, we live in a three-dimensional world of dense physical, liquid physical, and gaseous physical dimensions. But according to the wisdom teachings that go back all the way, you know, to ancient Hindu scriptures and Tibetan scriptures, etc. There are four higher planes of matter.
Absolutely.
Which are called etheric matter. And according to the teachings, life on the other planets in our system, in our solar system, for instance, has not precipitated down to the physical level, as to the dense physical level, as it has here on Earth, or either it has transcended, you know, through the evolution of consciousness, out of the dense physical planes and onto the higher etheric planes of matter, which so far are outside our range of vision. You know, just like there are frequencies of sound that escape our hearing, or frequencies of light that we don't see, Let's admit, let's just acknowledge that science itself says, astrophysics says, there's 96% of the universe that we can't detect, that we cannot pinpoint. So, you know, there's plenty of space there for civilizations on other planets, even though George Adamski was ridiculed for stating that. But that's what his contacts told him. We are from Mars, we are from Venus, we are from Saturn. He had the privilege of meeting these people, of being, informed with their wisdom, and he received, you know, highly teachings of high morality and physics and high morality and ethics, and his most impressive book, Inside the Spaceships, recounts the teachings that he received. And these are completely or entirely in line with the teachings that I've been studying all my life. That's the Wikipedia page. That's not really objective.
It's not fully accurate and objective. No, it's not Encyclopedia Britannica. Absolutely not.
It's always the first thing that pops up. A friend of mine called Wikipedia the idiocy of the masses.
It's a little out there, some of it. But yeah.
They don't do the kind of research that I've been doing.
You can also just kind of go in and add things.
I've tried that. I'll tell you, I've tried that. And it will just be edited out when they don't like it.
Precisely.
That's so much for Wikipedia.
The one thing that I had up on screen just a second ago that I always love to talk about is the actual electromagnetic spectrum. And the fact of, if you look right here, that is a very, very thin slice of reality, of the reality of the universe that we are actually exposed to. Like, we're exposed to all of this, but this is what our brains can process. This is what our organs, known as our eyes and ears, and our senses of touch, can actually see and hear and feel. Beyond that, there is a whole nother universe of things. There's a whole nother universe of frequencies, all kinds of things that are there.
And that's just covering, you know, the physical.
Yeah, precisely.
The physical planes of the universe, and there's higher planes of the universe that we haven't even begun to explore or acknowledge.
Yeah, like you said, once you start getting into other teachings, specifically the Indian teachings, things like that, of the Vedas, everything else, you're talking numerous universes, and that's quite literally what most theoretical physicists think is going on in the universe, is that it's actually more akin to suds in a sink, where there's a universe, where there's a bubble of a universe touching a bubble, touching a bubble, touching a bubble, and there may be a confluence where there's five or six universes touching at one point. You know,
we don't know. There's no way for us to know.
Now, with that, let's start kind of getting into some of the new book, the UFO UAP Disclosure, and the exopolitics question and the concept of exopolitics. Because once again, whether it's us from another dimension, like from Earth 38-9, or whether it's somebody from, as Adamski said, Venus coming down, we as a humanity have to be prepared for this question. We have to be, I'd have to think as close to on board together on the same page as possible. 'Cause the one thing I have brought up regularly, Gerard, is that if you were an interplanetary species that was approaching Earth long before you found Earth, you would find our signals. You would find our signal path. You would find our footsteps of our transmissions through the galaxy. Imagine seeing Earth from the concept of that and never having met humanity. All you have is our news and everything that we transmit to judge humanity by, like that,
our pollution.
That could be horribly frightening, man. You know, well, and if that's the first message that they're getting, we really, really, really have to hope beyond hope that, like, they are a fully enlightened species and don't judge people on first impressions.
Well, based on George Dempsey's experiences, and again corroborated by the experiences of other original 1950s contactees, you know. Let me just say that in the 1950s, the contactees began to attract, and especially George Adamski. You know, he had a massive audience, and his books were translated in many, many languages. And that started to worry the authorities, because his message, the message he was asked to give to the world, to share with the world, was that we need to find a way as a planetary species to cooperate, to seek international cooperation to avert nuclear disaster, nuclear annihilation. And that he, you know, and he and some of his fellow contactees were asked to share this message, because it came from people who had no social standing. They had no authority. They weren't the Pope or the Queen or the President. So that allowed the audience, the public, to respond from the heart to something that, you know, that makes sense, that had a ring of truth and a ring of wisdom. The civilizations that Adamski met were from Venus, from Mars, and other planets in our solar system, according to his accounts, and they are here. Again, he's not the only one who said that, to help us. You know, they are not, yeah, people, I understand, you know, for many people who haven't, who didn't dive into the original, the accounts of the original contactees as much as I have, you know, there's plenty of room for speculation. Where might they be from? My contention is that they are from within the solar system, based on my studies of the wisdom teachings and my studies of the accounts of the original contactees, but also based on logic. You know, we are talking about the evolution of consciousness here. We're not talking about a nice paranormal phenomenon raise humanity's curiosity. We are in a crucial stage of our evolution here, as witnessed by our technological achievements, as you mentioned. You know, and we are now at the point where we can destroy ourselves. Being an integral part of the solar system, that would affect the evolution of the whole solar system. See, we tend to think in terms of Earth being relatively solitary in terms of, you know, planets that harbors life. But life is a universal principle. There's no place in the universe without life. And if you look into systems science, systems philosophy, you will see that post-materialist scientists have found, based on their, you know, synthesis of findings from a whole range of scientific disciplines, that there's no end to evolution. I read a report just yesterday about a study in, I believe it was in America somewhere, an American university, where they had stripped down the molecule from the intestines of a goat, stripped it down, sort of simplified the organism to its bare essentials, and it would still evolve. It would still, you know, they expected it to sort of die and wither, but took on a life of its own, and it came back to life, so to speak. It started to, what cells do.
It started
to grow again. So there's no place in the universe where there's no life, and where there's life, you know, life manifests through the evolution of consciousness.
Absolutely. I just popped up the article from NASA talking about the search for life in the oceans of Enceladus, one of the moons of Saturn. And the idea of life, I think, I always apply what my abnormal psychology professor in college told me, which is, Chris, stop anthropomorphizing the gorillas. Stop trying to put a human action as to why the gorilla is throwing that stone. The gorilla just threw a stone. Write down that the gorilla threw a stone and what time he did. Once you take it beyond that, now you are being fully assumptive as to what the gorilla is doing and why the gorilla is doing it, instead of just observing the gorilla. And I think that we as a humanity, we tend to think that because we as a humanity strive to be a utopian society, air quotes there, folks, because we strive for that, we assume the fact that every interstellar civilization that would be able to travel amongst the stars would be that.
I disagree. There I would disagree with you.
Okay.
Because as I said, you know, system science finds that evolution, and I found this in the books summarized by Professor Irvin Laszlo, consciousness evolves towards ever greater unity. The Big Bang has spread out, you know, all the elements that that are needed for consciousness to coagulate, for clusters of vibration to coagulate, to come together and to form the chemical elements, to form planets and solar systems and galaxies, etc. And we find that, at least here on Earth, consciousness has gradually moved up the ladder from the mineral kingdom through the vegetable kingdom, through the animal kingdom, through the human kingdom, and it doesn't stop there. According to the wisdom teachings, you know, from the human kingdom has evolved a spiritual kingdom, as it's called, of people who used to be ordinary human beings, but who have transcended the strictly human state of consciousness. Now, consciousness, evolving consciousness, means that higher forms of consciousness, for instance, are a planet. A planet is a unit of consciousness in a solar system. A solar system is a unit of consciousness in a galaxy, and all have their role to play. Every planet in our solar system has its own humanity. Humanity is a universal occurrence, and even that is now, being acknowledged through evolutionary biologists who are increasingly looking at the theory of evolutionary convergence, the theory that wherever life takes a foothold, it will most likely evolve. And I'm talking about physical plane life now, that's their, that's their paradigm. Evolve along very similar lines and into very similar complex life forms as it has here on Earth. And that doesn't mean that all the planets outside Earth are more highly evolved. You know, we have planets in our solar system, and Adamski has said so, where humanity has not evolved to the point where we are.
Yeah.
But there are several planets, such as Venus and Saturn and Jupiter, where humanity has evolved far beyond the state of consciousness that we have achieved. And we are at this crucial and for now dangerous point, you know, crossroads in our evolution where we have to decide either we come together and stand together as a planetary race and protect our planetary home and look after each other, you know, and provide everyone with the basic necessities for life so that we don't have to compete for a place under the sun, or we continue on our along our old ways of competition, you know, and increasing conflict and eventual chaos and destruction.
Yeah.
And annihilate ourselves. That's the choice before us. And that's the philosophical side of exopolitics, I would say.
Yeah, precisely. And the conversation that you have to be ready to have, because like you were saying, even Adamski said that there are planets where they are not as evolved as us. Just because they can travel amongst the stars does not mean that they are societally as evolved.
Exactly.
Does not mean that they are seeking peace. Does not mean that, you know, and it kind of harkens back to the warnings of Stephen Hawking a little bit, where he was like, hey, you know, maybe we shouldn't be like attaching our DNA to satellites, you know, and showing alien civilizations what our makeup is, because they may not all have the best intention, you know, and that's just a logical thing to think. I think that we as humans tend to want to humanity the alien population. We tend to want to give them our look. We tend to want to assume the fact that they will have two arms, two legs, that they'll have
the human form seems to be universal.
Yeah, precisely. It doesn't necessarily mean that they couldn't be a cloud of interstellar intellectual material. You know, I would assume numerous ways in which life can exhibit itself, much like they are saying about the oceans of Enceladus. They are not saying that like merfolk are swimming in the ocean. What they're saying, folks, is that life takes numerous forms, and we need to look for that. And intelligent life takes numerous forms.
The point I was trying to make with what I was saying about the evolution of consciousness on planets, life on planets, you know, goes through these different kingdoms in nature, and the human kingdom is a universal occurrence.
Yes,
you'll find a human kingdom on any planet that has evolved to that stage, beyond that, you know, there are life forms that have transcended the human stage, but those higher life forms have gone through at some point in their evolutionary history, have gone through that stage of human evolution, without exception.
Yeah, so the same growing pain that we are going through right now.
The consciousness that is now our solar system in a galaxy long, long, many, many moons ago, many, many big bangs ago, at one point went through the human stage of consciousness, of conscious evolution. So there are other forms of life, but they are, you know, not incomparable. And it's not like there will be a planet somewhere in the vicinity of our solar system where the human kingdom would look like, you know, like green monsters with three eyes on sticks and things like that. The human form seems to be quite universal in that sense. You know, a trunk, two arms, two legs, two eyes. You may have seen in my latest book the photos that I included from Alberto Perego's book, the Italian contactee and member of the Italian friendship group, who was a group of over 120 Italians who had regular contact with extraterrestrials in underground bases around Italy, and they took photographs of spacecraft very similar to Adamski's, and not in this book, but in another book, in my second book, Here to Help UFOs and the Space Brothers, I included photos from another book from the same Italian author of the interior of a flying saucer. And in my latest book, I've reproduced photos of the pilot of a spacecraft. So, you know, and they look very similar, very recognizable.
And what do we as a humanity, Gerard, what do we have to do, not only, I guess, to prepare ourselves for this, but to prepare our society as a whole? Because, I mean, once again, whether they're friendly, whether they have ill intent, doesn't matter. I think that we have to be ready with a response communicatively. You know,
I think we need to be less concerned with a response. We need to be concerned with what the extraterrestrial presence teaches us. Mm. What it teaches us is that life is universal. Life is everywhere, and we need to accept that we are not competitors here on Earth. We need to accept that we need not fight for a place under the sun. We need not compete. We need not destroy each other. Yeah. Just because, you know, I make sure that through paying taxes or you know, making sure that every man, woman, and child through some United Nations agency has the basic necessities of life, adequate food, housing, healthcare, education, doesn't mean that, you know, I'm losing out. It means that we have to accept that we are brothers and sisters of the same planetary race. We share the same planetary home. We need to expand our understanding of being human. What it means to be human is that we are part of this living organism, it's part of the solar system, and together we can make this a paradise again in the heavens, a blue paradise that will provide for everyone.
Even
with the current level of overpopulation, which is of real concern, but sure, even with the current level of overpopulation, if we would share the available resources and food produce, technical know-how and medical know-how, nobody need die before their time.
Absolutely.
And that's what we need to do. That's what we need to concern ourselves with. And that's what the extraterrestrials are here to teach us. You know, the extraterrestrials who may not have evolved to our stage of consciousness, they are being kept out of our planetary system. In the past, they did come and did their thing for their own interests. Yeah. Since the 1950s, the extraterrestrials, and I have this from three separate sources: Wilbert Smith, the Canadian contactee, was told this. The American scientist who wrote under the pseudonym of Michael Wolff was told the same thing. And Benjamin Cram, the Scottish artist and esoteric teacher, was given the same information. Since the 1950s, the extraterrestrials have put in place a ring of light around our planet that keeps the negative cosmic influences away from, you know, being able to meddle with humanity. We are causing enough trouble as it is ourselves.
Absolutely.
You know, we don't need outside interference to do that. And if it weren't for their help, this planet would have been uninhabitable already with the nuclear fallout that is left unregistered. You know, there's so much negative effects of nuclear fallout on the etheric planes, the higher planes of matter, that our science doesn't register, which is causing the Alzheimer's, you know, the prolific profligation of the Alzheimer's disease. Our science doesn't even know that, doesn't register that. So they are here to help us at this crossroads in our evolution without interfering. They're not here to impose on us some kind of utopian society. It has to come from us. You know, if it's being imposed, it won't last because it doesn't come from our realization that this is the wise path to take.
It doesn't come from a source of transformation. It comes from a source of force.
Exactly. I mean,
much like any good epiphany in life that is life stealing. It's one of those that it can't be a forced moment.
Any lasting change has to come from within.
Yeah. Yeah. And even the concept of these alien races helping put a circle of light of protection around the world to keep bad things from interfering with the world. I mean, even that begs to show the fact that not all forces out there have our best interests at heart.
Exactly.
Gerard. Yep. And we as a humanity, we need to be ready to understand these other etheric planes. We need to be ready to accept their existence and the fact, because even if you his name escapes my head, but there was an Indian physicist probably a couple decades ago now, who many of his theories led to string theory, things like that. And he straight claimed that his gods helped give him those, that they came to him through divine revelation, during meditation and things like that,
radical insights, you know, and in the chapter in my book about consciousness, and I quote a few instances that, you know, and even in Einstein at one point said that, you know, he came to certain insights through a process that he could not prove how he got there. You know, we would call it intuition.
Oh, absolutely. One of my many, many nerdy life experiences, Gerard, is that I actively got to go visit the small apartment in Bern, Switzerland, where Albert Einstein actually came up with the idea of the theory of relativity. And that was fully from a dream. He woke up with this idea and started writing it down. And went through all kinds of, and yeah, once again, was laughed at by many in the scientific community for a long time. Even here in the last month, have we just confirmed the existence of gravitational waves?
Yes. Yes.
Those were an Einsteinian concept. They were there with all of that work and the concept of relativity, and have not been proven, have been part of calculation, everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In theory, but all of those theories have been nothing but theorem, because we've never been able to prove the existence of gravitational waves until we just heard the chorus of them.
Yeah,
for the first time about a month ago.
Measurements helped science to establish that that's an actual thing.
Yeah,
gravitational waves. Yeah,
yeah, precisely. And it was Srinivasa Ramanujan was the mathematician who had 3,900 formulae.
Oh, cool.
That were sourced from visions. There are stories about this for the longest time, Gerard. And it really is the fact of listening to last year, going to the Remote Viewing Association and hearing Hal Puthoff speak, and hearing it, because he has read in on many of the UFO UAP panels,
yes,
things like that. His work in laser science and his paper on how scientists may be inadvertently affecting their experiments when they go home and think about them.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is what led to the work of remote viewing and is now fully shown through, once again, to loop this conversation back in the work of, you know, Nobel winning scientists now, when you're talking about non-local consciousness and the idea of something beyond and a strange entanglement that exists between particles, between reality and what we believe to be other than, that's really just a higher part of that vibration.
Yeah. And between particles, you know, galaxies apart.
Yeah.
That's the fascinating thing. And so there's, you know, we are not separate from anything in the universe, even though, you know, it may escape our loftiest imaginations. But we need to realize that we are part of this universe, and even more so part of this planet that we are destroying by our current modes of living.
Exactly. I just popped up the Science Alert article about astronomers finding cosmic superhighways for fast travel through the solar system. These are things that we are just burgeoning on the technology of detecting. We are just coming to these realities, and the fact that these things that have been hypothetical and theoretical in science for years are actively coming to fruition. And it's amazing. I mean, just to see, I'm almost 50 years old. I'm 48 this year. And just to see what has happened in my lifetime, Gerard, the advances that have been made, for us to be now looking at, and granted, you know, once again, AI exists. Really, all it is an algorithmic way to organize information. That's what it is. When you get down to the root of all of it, that's what the AI that we have created is. That's why it's able to write things so fast, why it's able to give you like 5,000 words on a topic. It's going to cruise and peruse the internet, and hey, it may get some of its stuff from Wikipedia. It may get some of its stuff from Encyclopedia Britannica. You know, it may get some of its stuff from your work, Gerard.
You never know.
It's phenomenal to see what that intelligence engine can create, and to know that we have come up with that.
Yeah,
and that is now a thing.
Yeah, but the thing that intelligence machine cannot create, and what the scientific advances that we've seen, you know, in our lifetime, what needs to be done with them is that we need to take to heart the realization that we are all interconnected.
Yes.
And unless and until we do that and adjust our outlook on life and our modes of living in order to reflect that interconnectedness on a planetary scale, you know, unless we do that, we'll be destroying ourselves. And I don't think anybody in their right mind would really want to destroy him or herself or the planet. But we need to rid ourselves of the false notion that we are separated, that we are all separate individuals. Yes, we have our individual talents. We have our individual conditioning and backgrounds and you know, troubles in upbringing and frustrations and what have you. We need to overcome these limitations, these things that limit us, and certainly overcome our false idea of being separate from one another and come together, you know, as human beings, brothers and sisters, working together. We don't have to agree on everything. We don't have to think the same as everyone, because if we all thought the same, we would never come to a solution to a problem, because, you know, a solution takes all the different angles to be taken into account in order to find a good solution, a lasting solution.
Yeah.
We all need to contribute our talents, and we need to be, you know, need to be allowed to develop our talents through proper education that is now being denied to millions and millions of people, either through hunger or poverty or illness, preventable illnesses. And once everyone is allowed to enabled to grow up and you know, into healthy human beings and contribute their talents to the greater good, the common good, that will set us on the path to you know, to space travel, to space exploration, and we will be once again you know, embraced by the cosmic community of planets to begin with in our solar system. They are waiting for us to make that step.
Yeah,
you know, they are maybe not the inhabitants of Pluto, you know, that seems to be one of the lesser involved planets, but the brothers and sisters on Saturn and Jupiter and Venus and some other planet, Mercury, they are waiting for us to take this step.
And you know, it's interesting because the one thing I was going to say before you started that was, I think a lot of people's problems boils down to simple fear, Gerard. It's a big step to think about humanity-wise, to lose that concept. Because it's not necessarily, like you were saying, I think a lot of people's fear is that... You start thinking about, quote, one world governments. You start thinking about, you know, everybody losing their individuality and falling into their this freedom. Guideline. And that is not the case. That's not the case. No. And it was so beautiful to hear you say that. So beautiful to hear you say what we have to do is get to a point of being able to educate the individual to understand where they are, where their talents lie, how to bring those out so that they can be used for the betterment of society. Because that's exactly what we are missing. That is that appreciation for each other. We have lost this concept over, and it doesn't take long. Just since the time of our grandparents, you know, when we had victory gardens across Europe and America, where, hey man, sorry neighbor, that, you know, you're having a tough time because of the war. Here's some vegetables. You know, where we help take care of each other. And we've lost that. We've lost that concept of not only being an individual, but caring for each other as a society at the same time.
And being part of a community.
Yeah, yeah. Because,
you know, and now with
we're
the internet,
all suffering through the hard winter.
We should be able to see that we are part of an international community, a planetary community.
Precisely.
And, you know, it's also to do with a false notion of freedom. People think freedom, especially people in the United States, no offense.
No.
They seem to think freedom should be freedom to do as you like with no regard for the consequences to others.
Exactly.
Freedom, if your freedom depends on 50 million people, if your freedom to consume endlessly depends on 50 million of your fellow humans living and working in slavery, which is a reality at this time.
Absolutely. You know,
then it's not freedom, because then it depends on somebody else's bondage.
That's right.
That's
right.
Not freedom. Yeah. Freedom can only exist in a system where it is a universal, you know, quality for everyone together. And you can only achieve that through justice.
Beautifully,
you know,
said.
They need to be balanced. They need to be balanced, and they need, you know, you can only be free if everyone is free, and everyone can only be free if there's justice for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And at that point, you know, you really, it's about losing the idea of nationalisms. It's about losing the idea of not necessarily pride, where you came from, things like that, but joining with the idea of we are individual, e pluribus unum.
Exactly.
Of
yes.
one I, of and, many I am one.
And,
you know, and it takes the one to make up the whole. Like it takes a lot of little bitties to make up a big.
Yeah.
You know, and
no one,
I think
no one can do it by themselves.
Yeah.
You know? We need everyone.
Yeah. Precisely. And we need everybody's talents. We need everybody's skills. You know, everybody brings something different to the table. Gerard.
Just imagine the achievements, the strides we could have taken as a planetary race if we hadn't allowed for at least the last 40 or 50 years of you know, market freedom, so many people to die unnecessarily.
Well,
and living in abject poverty, you know, the talents that have been wasted.
Well, and, you know, I say it on the show regularly, because there's a hard line mentality in the U.S. in a lot of ways when it comes to homelessness, when it comes to social programs. And it's like, you know what, man, a hand up is not a handout. That is two different things. And I'm sorry if anybody's living on the dole. It's every one of those dudes that we voted into office. Yeah. It's getting paid for the rest of their life. That's the dude living on the dole, not the guy who came home from war that's living on the street with no mental health care.
You know, people manage to get elected to office, you know, the people who have millions already, who have a bigger bank account.
Exactly. Exactly. And yes, you know, it's because we've lost that founding father concept of we are here to do the greater good for our community, not to make a buck. Not a single founding father was at their ambition for that to be their career.
Exactly.
Yeah. It was never intended to be a job, guys. It was never intended to like, hey, I'm going to hold this position for 45 years. Right. That's my job. No, that was not your job.
And I'm going to help my corporate buddies so they can line
my parts. You were a doctor. You were a lawyer. You were a landowner. You know, you had industry behind you, something that helped you help your community. And you were vested in helping your community. Then when you were done, you were gone. Like, hey, this dude, it's his turn to help the community now. He's got some good ideas. Listen to him.
Yeah.
And well, we've lost that.
You're describing quite accurately the fact that all our systems are failing. Our political systems, our economic, financial, even our educational systems, they're all failing. And that's part of the transitional time that we are going through. The old structures are failing. They no longer fit our needs, that of course feeds people's fears.
Precisely.
But it's a necessary stage, I think, for people to ultimately come to the point where the choice before them is crystal clear. Are we going to continue in the old ways and destroy ourselves eventually, or will we take up the challenge and accept that we are part of, and all of us an invaluable individual part of a larger whole, and work together, find ways to work together and solve the problems, you know. Climate change, global warming, these things don't stop at national borders. They are global problems. Same as poverty. Poverty is not, you know, an African problem. Poverty is created in industrialized nations, and the result we see in people in their droves, in their hundreds of thousands, trying to get to the place where they know there are opportunities for them and their children. And now, you know, we are seeing a migration crisis. Well, you know, we caused that crisis with our economic systems. So the systems that have been in existence, you know, since the Industrial Revolution are no longer suited to our needs as a human race, because we have grown, even if we haven't acknowledged it yet.
Precisely. And we as a humanity have to get to a new point of enlightenment. The one thing that I give the example of all the time is never forget, we are still at the point with all of our technology that we let a dude irresponsibly fling a convertible into the great beyond. Just fling it out like, hey, did it go through any lab measures? Did we make sure that it wasn't covered with microbes? Did we make sure that it didn't have human viruses all over it before we flung it into the great beyond of space to maybe land on another planet and totally infect it?
We're all made of the same stardust. So yeah, I don't think that should be a major worry of ours.
Even the idea of the strange ball of string that was found by the Mars Perseverance rover. Like, that was actual litter from the rover. Like, we're actively going and littering another planet to explore planet, you know, and that's kind of the mentality that we have to get ready to lose, Gerard, is that we are impacting another planet by merely exploring the planet.
Even without littering the moon and Mars and, you know, sending probes, of course, you know, it's a first step that humanity is taking into space. And these probes, you know, they are physical plane things that will disintegrate. And I'm not worried that they will contaminate.
But the pollution of our planet is Vedic plane, man. Yes. That like reverberates to the rest of the solar system.
And that's what I'm trying to say. You know, we are affecting the rest of the solar system in a negative way by not taking that step, you know. And until we take that step, for now we're holding back the evolution of the solar system. As it is, and that's the greater concern that we should have. Even though for most people, I don't think that's much of a reality yet. But we will get to that place when we realize there's no way out of this planet. Unless we solve our problems.
Yeah. You know, and once again, I think really that is this one of the many seeds of the plant that is exopolitics, is we have to fully see what our impact is, period. We have to to fully realize that we are responsible for the vibration that we drag into the party. You know, when you come into a party and you're a downer and you got a bad attitude and it just kind of dampens the party, it's the same way, no different with the vibration of humanity and how we affect the solar system, how we affect the greater reality of local, of the non-local reality.
Yes. You know? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because, you know, that's where it reverberates.
Yeah.
Just to hook on to your reference to exopolitics, in my little booklet, which is also available as a free PDF before disclosure, I propose an alternative definition of exopolitics, going back to the original meaning of its constituents, with exo meaning from outside and politics meaning matters concerning the state or its citizens. My definition of exopolitics would be people from other planets showing humanity alternative, saner ways of organizing society without imposing their views. And that's based on, the accounts of the original contactees and their experiences.
Well, precisely. And once again, learning to not only balance that, but balance that with the fact of what is our impact upon their society. You know, us holding ourselves back evolutionally, how are we holding them back? How are we stifling them? Because they're kind of waiting on us. Who's dragging feet?
Us.
Yeah. We're the ones dragging feet in that situation, not them. And it's an interesting conundrum to think about psychologically and philosophically when it comes to this issue, especially when it comes to issues of disclosure, you know, because we are just now getting to the point of and getting to the point of having the conversation. I've said it in the last many episodes that you probably hear the discussion of paranormal around more tables here and in Europe than you do politically at a family get together now, you know, of like, do you see this thing on the news about like Chuck Schumer saying that they've seen things that'll scare the hell out of us? What's that about? You know, as opposed to like the headbutting conversation that we were having just prior to COVID. Yeah. You know,
it was interesting that Schumer also seemed to have said, which wasn't reported as far as I found in American media, but it was reported in a Dutch newspaper and an Indian newspaper, that he said, you know, apparently their technology is so advanced that, and they've been around for so long, they could have, you know, if they had ill intentions, they could have done whatever they wanted to do long ago. But so I don't think that they are, they have any bad intentions.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. If they had bad intentions, that would have been revealed long ago. It would have been very
Why would they have waited until we had developed nuclear power, you know?
Yeah, yeah, precisely. It would have been very much the Independence Day situation if they show up and go, hi, by the way, we're taking everything now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that would have been leveraged long, long ago. And like you were saying, these other races have seen fit to come and put that protective technology around us to help prevent that from happening.
Well, yeah. Well, to help prevent negative cosmic influence, you know, if we are in such a mess already, the mess that we created, and they realize, these more highly advanced civilizations from Mars and Venus and Saturn, that we are so vulnerable, especially to materialist views, you know, we're so engrossed and imprisoned by this sense of being separate and needing to compete and fending for ourselves individually, that it would be very easy to create even more polarization and opposition among humans, you know, and the cosmic materialist cosmic forces would do anything to help humanity to take the next step and break up the planet, or, you know, destroy the let humanity destroy the planet and thereby set back the evolution of the solar system. And that's what they're preventing by, you know, by this protective ring of light around Earth, so that humanity can come to the place where, as I said, you know, where the choice before us is clear, and the choice that we make will come from a place of an informed decision, of wisdom, of recognized truth, and necessity. That's where we're at.
Absolutely. Gerard, I want to thank you for your candid conversation on this topic, because it's a heady one, and it's one that I think a lot of people, once again, philosophically may have issue with. And it's something that we as a humanity really need to come to some quick terms with, whether you are of a religious nature or not does not preclude spirituality, folks. And what you need to do is you need to hit that spiritual section of the bookstore, and you really, like, you need to get some kind of spiritual grounding in life to understand that you are a part. You're only an atom in the molecule, you know?
Yes.
And the subtraction of you utterly changes the molecule. The subtraction of that one little proton changes the whole atom.
Yeah, and the you know, what we need to realize is that the atoms that make up our personality that we see in the mirror in the morning, they are not even the real us.
Yeah,
you know, that's they are just the outer manifestation of the what some would call the spiritual foundation nature of what it means to be human, and on that level we are all connected.
Yeah.
You know, and if people have you know, find it difficult to deal with this spiritual, metaphysical, religious notion, they really should read chapter 7 in my latest book, where I bring this where I close this gap between you know, religious, metaphysical, spiritual notions and scientific notions, because they find, if you look at the core of all world religions, you find that they you know, they are really about the evolution of consciousness. It's
absolutely
about reconnecting our individual consciousness with the source of consciousness, in religious terms, God. System science has now found that that is exactly the direction that evolution takes, you know. So
such an amazing conversation and such an amazing book as well. I have thoroughly enjoyed it. Stop on by and get your copy of the Adamski Book of UFO UAP Disclosure. That is the latest work by Gerard Artson. Gerard, other than our website, let everybody know where they can go to find your books, where they can go to keep up with blogs, videos, where they can go to keep up with everything that you were involved in.
My books are available on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, or you know, if you're in the UK, Waterstones, Foyles, all the, you know, any website of a major online bookseller. And if people want to keep track of my whereabouts, interviews or talks, they can go to the website that you mentioned, bgapublications.nl. The .nl is for the Netherlands, but the website is in English, and all the information is there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much again for your time, for the candid conversation.
Having me.
I would love to have you on again and again and again, because I think, once again, I think this is one of the biggest issues facing humanity right now.
I think we only scratched the surface.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I'd love to have you on to go deeper in this and to explore your work even more. Please do hold the line while we close things out with our audience, Gerard. Of course, folks, while you are online checking out all of the amazing work of Gerard Artson over at bgapublications.nl, make sure to stop on by curiousrealm.com. That is our website. That is where you can find all of our guests' information. That's where you can visit our store, curiousrealm.com/store, and get all of the books by Gerard Artson, as well as our other guests. All you have to do is click the book title. It'll take you straight to Amazon, where you can purchase that book. Stop on by and check that out, curiousrealm.com/store. And of course, if you're an experiencer of the paranormal, UFOs, UAPs, if you have had a cryptid encounter, if you are a targeted individual or government witness, stop on by curiousrealm.com/story and share your story with us. There's a form there where you can anonymously share your story, where you can share your pictures, data, videos, audio clips, everything. We will share your information with our professionals and our guests and try and get you some answers for your situation. So thank you so much, as always, everybody, for tuning in. Thank you for tuning in for the many years that we've been around. I greatly appreciate it. Until next time, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, curiousrealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.